Natural and artificial symbols. Hi, it's Matej, and this is Surviving Art. Just as with sweeteners and coffee, you have natural and artificial options to spice up your art too. Both sweeteners and symbols are created by molding reality to our will. But unlike aspartame and the like, artificial symbols don't have negative health side effects. Unless we count war and propaganda, of course. But it does, though, open up our work to the possibility of being misinterpreted. And in today's blunder, we're going to take a peek at how we can at least guide our audience into the right direction, as well as take a jab at the underlying question that many of you might be asking yourselves. Namely, if there even is a right direction with art. We might just as easily say that any perspective is a valid one and that there are no wrong ways to understand the work of art. Well, let's find out. First, let's take the basic idea of a symbol and, using our tiny mental equivalents of surgical equipment, our thoughts, try to see if we can't find a good and workable definition of what a symbol actually is. The problem isn't that symbols are amorphous blobs that evade scrutiny every time we try to observe them closely. This isn't quantum physics. The real issue comes forth because of the exact opposite. You can't but see something in anything you observe attentively. Symbols really are just neatly assembled and wrapped ideas that were made presentable and therefore intriguing enough to stand out from the crowd, everything else the world has to offer us as far as experiences go. To be clear, we're not going to talk exclusively about visual symbols because the experience and inner workings of symbolic structures are more or less the same, regardless if we look at them, hear them, or smell them. Albeit, we, of course, will be focusing on visual arts, because, well, mainly because my numbers say most of you lovely souls listening to this are visual artists just like me, and evaluations of sheet music just don't ring as true to us as a nice, juicy red Barn Newman painting, for example. Also, I do have to address all of you philosophy and linguistic aficionados. When I say semantics, symbolism, but I never use the term semiotics. As far as I'm concerned, all three mean more or less the same thing. This isn't due to ignorance, but because semiotics being the study of symbols and semantics being the study of the meanings of words in the end combine into one big splashy field of study. And that's exactly where we're going today. Symbolism is to words like water is to rivers. You could have a river of oil or ketchup, but when you hear the word river, it's just much more likely that water is going to be involved. The same goes for symbolic structures. You have non-linguistic symbolism, we will talk about that later, but the majority of symbols we encounter in our daily lives that actually do spark our interest, especially our intellectual interests, are all built on language and operate by its rules. So, symbolism. The human mind is a wonderful piece of media equipment, especially one part of it, residing somewhere in our prefrontal cortex that not only makes us the apex predators on the planet, if we do not count the penis fish or candiru of the Amazonian rainforest, that creature scares me to death. But the same part in our brains also gives us the ability to be attentive. And if you've been part of this channel for a while, you know how I love attention and the old myths regarding its importance. Attention is the cornerstone of the human condition. It's the starch and agar-agar that holds our fragile whipped cream-like amalgamation of anxiety, fear of death, and other basic drives at reasonable bay, and in a homogeneous enough shape so that we can, even though nihilism is just a thought away, still kind of enjoy the finer things of life. Like ice cream, art, and thinking about things. Attention is also the basis of how symbolic structures and understandings are formed in our brains. Without us being attentive enough, we could never really learn the meaning of something, and therefore would be forced to uncover meanings in things, people, and other phenomena every single time we'd encounter them. Rather than how it works right now, where we have a basic concept saved somewhere in our meat noodle and use it to maneuver throughout the world. Take a stop sign, for example. It takes attention to be able to focus on a red piece of octagonally shaped sheet of metal painted on with four white scribbles of lines and see a prompt to stop. It takes even more attention to learn that said collection of red and scribbles is actually a universal prompt that can be found almost all around the world and that every time we encounter it, we have to stop. Were we not to possess this ability to memorize certain collections of either words, images, or even just sounds and smells into our system, or to say differently, symbols, we would have a panic attack every single time we sat in our car, got to the supermarket, or probably even every time we turned on our tap at home to get a drink of water. Especially if your tap is actually a faucet, that's the American way to say it, and it most likely doesn't produce clean drinking water. Without our ability to think and experience life via symbolic structures, causality would be a cruel and completely foreign mistress indeed. But that's luckily not the case. We do learn to maneuver through life via symbolic structures or ideologies, and my favorite example for how symbols work is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I lied, there will be a bit of sheet music analysis after all, but don't judge me for it. Since its creation, the Ode to Joy has been used by a myriad of different, even contradicting causes to propagate their ideas. Used by both governments of Nazi Germany, Communist China, by the protesters in Chile demonstrating against Pinochet and the then ruling class, it was played at the fall of the Berlin Wall. It was played by Christians, Buddhists, and all sorts of other religions. It was also the theme song of the USSR, old school talk for Communist Russia, picked by Stalin himself. In short, everybody and their fascist grandma used to relate to that song, while just over the border the same tune was played by diehard communists. And now, it's the unofficial hymn of the European Union. It's a lot like if the song Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees was used by both sides of any conflict. The concert itself would probably be aired in some neutral country like Switzerland, with speakers faced into the direction of the fighting countries. And the song would just be blasted into the battlefield with everybody, regardless of side, religion or mindset, relating to the same thing. The beauty and sheer amount of grace three pairs of airtight trousers can unleash in a society without autotune. If they only knew what was coming. Well, my example is based on music. It works in visual art all the same. There's a wonderful story somebody told in a video somewhere on YouTube, I think. Might be Peterson, but it could also be Zizek. Or any other philosopher slash psychologist fond of either lobsters or other people's toilets. So I really couldn't say for sure. He said that he owns a portrait of Stalin that he proudly hung on one of the walls in his home. But, being someone that despises the horrific deed that man was capable of doing, that portrait doesn't hang there as a token of reminiscence or as a symbol of some old, partly forgotten way. He keeps it there because of the sheer fact that he can watch the ideology of the painting slowly crack and fade away. Meaning, now it might still be a portrait of Stalin, the horrible person, but over time, in maybe 100 or 200 years, when nobody that actually remembers what happened firsthand is still alive, he'll just be another all-important guy on a painting. Just like the rest of them, probably exhibited in some museum and sorted on the merit of date or technique, not deeds. He might even be hung next to some old Russian icon of Jesus. When ideology vanishes from people's hearts and minds, it leaves its products empty, and only the technical traits like size, color, texture, motif, and composition stay. So, ideologies, or structures of symbols, are empty of meaning when the context is removed from the equation. The only thing that stays, regardless if a painting is presented inside a religious, political, or plain old white cube context, are natural symbols. Natural symbols, unlike their counterparts, symbols of the artificial variety, sounds a little bit like a Philip K. Dick novel, doesn't it? Well, they are timeless and non-linguistic. As their name implies, they originate not from any man-made context, like language, but from a wider, much, much older context of nature itself. For example, nature is more than 4 billion years old. People, on the other hand, have existed for only about a couple of hundred thousands of years. Even just a couple of thousand years if we only start counting from the first known formations of civilizations, where a lot of the artificial symbolic systems we all know and love, like the Bible, Quran, Talmud, and other religious texts that have shaped Western society, were formed. But I'm sure all of us that ever spent at least a few hours studying visual art theory, or just went to school, really, are more familiar with a different name that our field has given to natural symbols. Basic artistic elements, or design elements if you studied design. There are 7 of them to be exact. Line, shape, space, volume, form, texture, and color. Other natural symbols include the second basis assortment of artistic tools, the principles of art or design. Unity and harmony, balance, hierarchy, scale or proportion, dominance or emphasis, and similarity or contrast. All of these basic features that anything in the world has, especially in the world of art, well, they are not man-made. They are the features around which our perception and interaction with the world evolved. On the opposite side are artificial symbols. These are all man-made structures, like symbols for love, or hate, or appreciation. Think of how various differences between cultures, especially the East and West, create an incredibly disparate context around the same symbol, like the OK sign. A gesture where the thumb and index finger are connected and the rest left to kind of form a mohawk, but with fingers, is more or less known to communicate agreement or content with something. Like in Japan, for example, where it means wealth and is therefore a good thing. But in the Middle East, it usually represents an anus and is meant as an offensive gesture, pointing towards the recipient not only having an anus, but also being one. In Kuwait, for example, the same gesture is understood as an evil eye, a curse laid on the recipient. And in places like France, it gets even more convoluted because of the cultural diversity of the country. It can mean both a good and a bad thing to different people depending on the facial context. The point to take home is to have one's hands under control when traveling, and that artificial symbols, unlike natural ones that always mean more or less the same thing, depend on their context to give them meaning, or their semantic value. Depend on their context to give them meaning, or their semantic value, as it is also called. And you can also combine natural and artificial symbols together. That's more or less the majority of all symbolism, really, an amalgamation of both. While a line will always be a line, and a dot will always be a dot, we can make an amalgamation by drawing 2 dots and writing sesame seed under one of them and butthole under the other. The point is that understanding the difference between natural and artificial symbols is imperative if we wish to help guide our viewers throughout the labyrinth of experiencing our art. While, of course, even the most basic of shapes and colors can become imbued with subjective, extremely personal meanings for some people, for example, winning 100 million euro in a lottery while being dressed completely in baby blue clothes will leave an imprint on the mind. Well, for most people, natural symbols usually still have a similar meaning and offer similar impulses to most of them. But it's also not impossible to predict how certain groups of people will read a certain artificial symbol either. Punks will usually see the symbol for anarchy when confronted with the letter A painted onto a wall, but it could just as well be a badly painted logo for the new Avengers movie, and Marvel fans will most likely only see that meaning. And many won't even notice it, because they have no deep relation to the symbol itself. That's why some people see something in art and others just don't. They are just projecting what they think is important to them onto the work they are experiencing. And that's also why art is such a wonderful and powerful medium. When confronted with a good, layered and complex work of art, it will eventually show us, just like the mirror in Harry Potter, exactly what we are striving for, whether we like it or not. Our job as artists, therefore, is not to produce blindly and unconnected with our environment, but to carefully craft our products in such a fashion that they become part of the zeitgeist, of the now. Only then can both artificial and natural symbols work in unison, forming a strong and easily legible communications channel with our audience and giving them not only the ability to see what is important to us as creators, but also what is most dear to them. In the end, we merely facilitate the artistic experience by making art. The viewers are the true artists, creating the artistic experience by immersing themselves into our work and opening up enough to internalize it as part of themselves. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Surviving Art.